The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On our previous program, we began the article, Consider the Date, by Maddie Friedman. Sweet or mellow, the bread of the desert has fed humanity and shaped the past for thousands of years. But how will the ancient fruit fare in the changing world? The article started with a simple phrase, it's possible to divide the world in two. The part that venerates the humble-seeming fruit known as the date, and the part that does not. The part that does is home to hundreds of millions of people, from the Atlantic coast of Morocco, across North Africa and Egypt, to Mesopotamia and east to India. In Arabian Sands, Wilfred Thesinger's classic account of his travels through the famous empty quarter of Arabia in the 1940s, the British writer and explorer mentions Abu Dhabi as a sleepy coastal village on the desert's edge. He would not recognize the metropolis that has sprung up since, thanks to the more profitable brown product exported by the United Arab Emirates, of which Abu Dhabi is now the capital. In my time there, I learned that when local people reach for an expression of their authentic selves, from the time before oil changed everything, they reach for the date. The pillars at the Grand Mosque, for example, are designed like date palms, gleaming white columns topped with golden fronds. In the neighboring Emirate of Dubai, there's an entire artificial island shaped like a date palm. Another thing that I learned is that if you type dates in Abu Dhabi into Google, not everything that comes up is related to fruit. The first stop for modern date connoisseurs might be the luxury date chain Batil, which has a franchise next to the Nespresso store at the Abu Dhabi Mall. According to the salesperson named Wendy, the biggest seller in the pre-Ramadan high season was a date stuffed with salted macadamia nuts, though one with candied orange peels was also going fast. A golden date box emblazoned with the traditional greeting, Ramadan Kareem, seemed like a good souvenir until I calculated the exchange rate and realized it came to $400. The ordinary customer might be better advised to take a cab to a less fashionable part of town and visit Al Mina Wholesale Market. Many of the workers here, like Nishard Karath at Ashik Dates, are Indians from the state of Kerala. Karath gave me a tour of his shelves, 2 dozen varieties of the fruit, and also date vinegar, date jam, date seed coffee, pickled dates, and cookies made from dates and camel milk. A few stores down, I met Muhammad Ali, also from Kerala. He told me that the big medjools are popular, but mainly with tourists. Locals prefer the Emirati Kalas and the Saudi Sukari, which are smaller and homelier and have a complex taste that hints at caramel and coffee. I tasted them all, and the locals know what they're talking about. In the pre-Ramadan rush, Ali said, his store was moving about 2,200 pounds of dates every day. But all is not well in the date world. The enemy is at the gates. And this is what brought me to Abu Dhabi, the scene of the International Date Palm Conference, held at the Emirates Palace Hotel under the royal patronage of President Sheikh Khalifa bin Zayed Al Nahyan. The elderly Sheikh died in May 2022, not long after my visit. The conference played out beneath vast chandeliers and life-size artificial palm trees. At a stand near the escalators, a representative of the Emirati date concern, ZAD, handed out cookies made with date sugar, and also wondrous dates that tasted exactly like chocolate, which turned out to be fake dates made of chocolate. The date palm has many old antagonists, fruit rot, for example, or the black scorch. but none matches the red palm weevil. Native to the Indian subcontinent, the weevil reached the Middle East in 1985 with a shipment of palms from Southeast Asia to a port in the Emirates, according to Jose Romano Valerio of Goa, India, one of the top scholars in the field. The weevil has conquered most of the ecological habitats across the world, Valero told the audience. From the palm enclave of Elche in southeastern Spain to the Caucasus on the southern border of Russia. At another session, an Emirati scholar named Ali El-Batay laid out the grim statistics. 50 million farmers worldwide are affected by the weevil, which burrows into the trees and eats them from the inside until they die. Around the Mediterranean alone, the weevil's damage is estimated at more than 450 million euros as of 2019. Meki Chouibani of Morocco offered a grim prediction that he illustrated in cartoon images projected on a screen. First, a weevil infestation, then a loss of income, abandonment of trees, encroaching desertification, and finally a farmer forced to leave home, hunched over with a pack on his back. The weevils are everywhere. Many palms in my Jerusalem neighborhood have fallen victim, including one across the street that expired as I wrote this article. If the weevil poses a global problem, it has also summoned global ingenuity. One solution proposes drones with thermal cameras that can spot infestations. Trees invaded by weevils are hotter than healthy trees, and the hope is that if infestations are caught early, individual trees can be treated without spraying a whole orchard with pesticide. Other solutions have been tried and abandoned, like dogs trained to smell or hear the bugs as they burrow into the trunk. My personal favorite is a contraption devised by Italian scientists called the Eco Palm Ring, which looks like a giant metal dog collar, but is actually a circular microwave. The ring wraps around the trunk and is lifted by a crane up the length of the tree, cooking the weevils inside. Of particular interest at the conference was the presence of a few Israelis, which would have been hard to imagine a few years ago, before the American-engineered agreements known as the Abraham Accords inaugurated official ties between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Morocco. If we understand the date palm as a unifier in a divided part of the world, dates offer an obvious field of cooperation. A weevil sensor manufactured by an Israeli company, for example, has already been drilled into thousands of trees in the UAE and Morocco, as well as in Arab countries that won't trade directly with Israel, but purchase the sensors through a third party. The sensor picks up the vibrations of weevil larvae and sends a warning to an app installed on the farmer's smartphone. Conference participants heard that Dror Shalatin, the Israeli CEO of a company that has pioneered a genetically engineered substance that is injected into date palms and eaten by the weevil. Once ingested, it switches off a vital gene and kills the bug without leaving any chemical trace, as a pesticide would. The precise details are a trade secret. Eventually, Shalatin told me, the substance can be genetically engineered into the trees themselves, making them weevil-proof. The panel's moderator was noticeably cold to the Israeli, and one woman slipped out when he stood up to speak, suggesting that dates can't overcome all entrenched divisions. But most participants seemed open-minded, and the Emirati organizers did their best to make their Israeli guests feel welcome. Sarah Salin, the Israeli researcher behind Methuselah and the Resurrection Project, received an award for her work. The conference was an argument for shared tastes and affinities, or at least for the salutary effects of a common enemy. In this case, a little red bug that cares nothing for borders or religion, but only about date palms, and needs to be fought by people who share that way of thinking. Date palms have been domesticated for so long that it's easy to forget that they once grew wild. Occasionally, you'll see a palm growing alone somewhere, like a gleefully escaped convict, feral and unkempt, surrounded by offshoots protruding from the trunk. looking less like a tame orchard tree than like a fierce bush. But these are cultivated palms gone rogue, not authentically wild trees. In fact, for a long time, no one could find the date palm's true ancestors. A few years ago, Brose Balthazar, the French scientist, heard from colleagues about unusual palms growing in the Hajar Mountains of northern Oman. The trees produce strikingly small seeds, the researchers observed, a common feature of wild plants, which have not been bred to bear larger fruit. Brose Balthazar and her team sequenced the tree's genome and found that they were dramatically more diverse than the palms we know. And in 2017, they published the article in Current Biology, announcing that the elusive wild date palm had finally been discovered. The wild palms are not just a curiosity. The world is warming and the population is growing. So a tree that likes the heat and produces durable fruit with a wide range of uses has a lot to offer. But to survive, even venerable domesticated palms will need to adapt new characteristics, such as the ability to deal better with drought. Many useful traits have been lost during thousands of years of breeding, but they may well be found again in the more varied genomes of wild palms, which have been getting by on their own for millennia, in desert wadis without irrigation. It's because you're diverse that you can adapt, Brose Balthazar said. What's coming is climate change, increasing drought, and water salinity, everything that is threatening the date palm population right now. The wild date palms might carry some interesting adaptations, and these could be bred with cultivated date palms to create the date palms of the future. It's impossible to say what this part of the world will look like in centuries to come, or what sort of people will be bustling around at ground level, eating, quarreling, and telling each other stories. But it's safe to say that whoever they are, somewhere nearby will be a stand of these trees, traveling gracefully through space and time without moving an inch. Next, we'll move on to an article titled Invisible Evidence by Joe Marchant. Touch something and you leave behind a trace of yourself that can last for centuries. Now scientists are learning to decode those molecular signals, opening a new frontier in the study of the past. But what does it really mean to find that Jack London might have had diabetes? Welcome to the stickiest topic in history. One rainy morning in May, a Romanian archivist named Tudor Ahir retrieved a brown envelope from a wooden filing cabinet, slid out a small yellowed page, and placed it carefully on the table. Ahir is the custodian of the government archive in Sibiu, Romania, a medieval city in the region of Transylvania. Inside the grand historic building, elegant windows and parquet floors contrasted with yellowed lace curtains and battered upholstery. On a desk in the corner, a pile of books and parchments spanned hundreds of years. The document he produced was a letter, more than 500 years old. Despite the ancient creases and stains, its 9 lines of flowing Latin script, translated long ago, were clearly legible. But nobody here was intended to read it. Instead, 2 visitors, a married couple named Gleb and Svetlana Zilberstein, waited eagerly with latex gloves and plastic tubes. The letter is one of the archive's most precious possessions. Dated August 4, 1475, it was written to the burghers of Sibiu by a man describing himself as the prince of the Transalpine regions. He informed the townspeople that he would soon be taking up residence among them. He signed with a name sure to strike fear into their hearts, Vlad Dracula. Dracula had previously ruled the neighboring region of Wallachia, and he was known for his cruelty, especially his practice of impaling enemies on stakes, thus his nickname, Vlad the Impaler. Now he was preparing to gain the Wallachian throne once again. His letter to Sibiu's residents is one of only a few sparse documents related to the notorious prince who centuries later would inspire Bram Stoker's fictional vampire, Count Dracula. The Zilbersteins were interested not in the words on the page, however, but something else. Physical remnants of the prince himself, including molecule fragments from his sweat, saliva, and tears. Their work harnesses breathtaking advances in a field known as proteomics, which seeks to understand the interaction of proteins with living cells and organisms. Proteins have long been studied in the context of biology and medicine, but spectacularly sensitive analytical techniques now allow researchers to use protein traces to gather intimate information from materials that were once primarily the domain of historians and archaeologists, opening a new window into the past. The project is part of a scientific revolution that is profoundly expanding the type of information that can be gleaned from historical texts and artifacts, from X-ray and CT scanning to carbon dating and genetic sequencing. Already, DNA is used to identify individuals from biological remains and reveal large-scale relationships, from family trees to evolutionary timelines. But DNA remains constant throughout a person's life, and it degrades badly over time, which is why researchers are interested in proteins, the molecules DNA encodes and that do most of the work inside our cells. If DNA keeps a static record of our ancestry, proteins, which metabolize our food, store and transport resources, and carry messages from one place to another, provide a running commentary on our health and habits. They leave evidence of our diets, our illnesses, the drugs we use, even our cause of death. And they are left behind on everything we touch. Until recently, researchers hoping to detect traces of ancient proteins needed to destroy a small sample of the material in question in order to isolate enough molecules to get a readable signal. This isn't usually a problem with biological remains such as bones or fossils, but few archivists are willing to damage an invaluable artifact like Dracula's letter. But Gleb, an Israeli entrepreneur and inventor originally from Soviet Kazakhstan, has designed a material that can coax protein molecules from the surface of paper, parchment, and paintings, even mummies and woolly mammoths, without damaging the object themselves. Working with Pier Giorgio Righetti, an Italian chemist, he and Svetlana have used this method to explore a range of archives, arousing both excitement and consternation among historians as the researchers report the unsuspected activities of iconic figures from Johannes Kepler to Joseph Stalin. Alongside these unconventional pioneers, researchers around the world are experimenting with other minimally invasive methods to persuade protein molecules away from the objects they have clung to for decades, centuries, or millennia. This means that curators like Arhayer should brace themselves for a profound shift in identity. They are now keepers of not only texts and manuscripts, but also biological stories reaching far beyond the written word. Zilberstein and Righetti's journey into the past began a decade ago with a battered, crumbling Bible. Righetti, a chemist at Milan Polytechnic University, has spent most of his career developing methods to separate proteins with increasing precision. Now 81, Righetti is tall, with blue eyes and a neat white goatee. Energetic and seemingly unaffected by the heat when I meet him in Milan one warm day this past spring, he led me on a blistering tour through the city's streets and galleries, joyfully pointing out medieval courtyards, magnificent cloisters, and a World War II submarine displayed on the grounds of the National Science Museum. Righetti grew up in grim poverty. His father fought in the Second World War, and the family became homeless after fleeing Allied forces. His earliest memory is of living in tents under the rafters of an old castle, Families were separated by hanging sheets. After several years in a seminary, training to become a priest, at age 15, Righetti quit and rejoined his family in Milan. Viewing science as his best chance for a more prosperous future, he studied organic chemistry, earning a PhD from the University of Pavia. He fell in love with proteins, and even now he speaks about them not as molecules, but as characters in a human drama. They build things, sweep the streets, put people in prison. Without them, we couldn't live. Righetti became an expert in using electromagnetism to coax protein molecules through gel, a process known as electrophoresis, and he traveled extensively over the years to teach the techniques he pioneered to scientists all over the world. In 2010, a group of Italian researchers asked Righetti, in the twilight of an already accomplished career, if he could retrieve anything from a few crumbs of a disintegrating Bible, written in Latin, that was taken to China in the 13th century and returned to Italy 400 years later. Hoping to learn more about the Bible, which some speculate may have belonged to Marco Polo, the researchers had painstakingly reassembled the book from more than 10,000 pieces and concluded that it was made in northern France in the 1230s. They wondered if further clues might be held in the leftover fragments. Rather than use electrophoresis, Righetti opted to try a more powerful technique called mass spectrometry. Once used to analyze uranium isotopes during World War II, the technology works by converting molecules in a sample into a gas of charged ions. For example, by bombarding them with a beam of electrons and using electric and magnetic fields to separate the ions as they travel at high speed through a vacuum. The resulting mass spectrum, which shows the mass to charge ratios of the ions plotted against their intensities, acts like a molecular fingerprint. Researchers were increasingly using the technology to study proteins, but applying it to ancient degraded samples was an enormous challenge. Righetti's first attempts to extract trace proteins from a tiny parchment fragment using the digestive enzyme trypsin failed to produce any results. Eventually, after first softening the sample in a microwave, he succeeded and detected 8 distinct proteins. The results show that the parchment was made from calf tissue rather than fetal lamb tissue, as was long assumed. The finding itself may have been of only niche interest, but Righetti was one of the first researchers to show that proteins really could yield information about historical artifacts. Still, the Bible, with its disastrous state of preservation, was a special case, and the technique's potential for historical scholarship seemed limited. Few other curators would be willing to let Righetti, or anybody else, destroy even a sliver of a treasured artifact in order to analyze it. Then he got a call from Gleb Zilberstein, with whom he'd collaborated on other projects in the past. "I know how we could do it without needing to take a sample," he said. Like Righetti, Zilberstein saw science as a path to a better life. Now 53, he grew up in a Soviet industrial town on the West Siberian plain. "Everything was gray," he says. When he was 10, his uncle gave him a fossil collection, including ammonites and shark's teeth from the Kazakh desert, which once lay at the bottom of an ancient sea. His eyes light up as he talks about it, pointing his fingers toward his forehead as if zapping his brains with rays of energy. "To see these fossils, it makes you crazy," he says. "Even if you live in a poor country, you can find bright things." He studied chemistry and physics at the Novosibirsk State University in Siberia, where he met Svetlana, who was also a student at a nightclub. Gleb's degree was interrupted by 2 years of compulsory military service, but he avoided routine duties by inventing a new type of gas mask that captured volatile, organic compounds using a filter made from dried blood. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Greb declined to apply for either Russian or Kazakh citizenship. And after college, he and Svetlana immigrated to Israel, where they now live in Tel Aviv near the ocean. Gleb has since founded a series of companies that commercialize his proprietary technologies, many of which capture molecules using their own minute electrical charges. One of Zilberstein's products was designed to kill bacteria by pulling on their proteins to break apart their cells. After seeing Rigetti's journal article about the Marco Polo Bible, Zilberstein realized that technology might be adapted to historical research by using the same method to tease molecules off an artifact's surface while leaving the object intact. On the phone, he explained to Rigetti that he'd already engineered several polymers that could attract proteins and other types of molecules according to their charge. Rigetti was sold. For their first experiment, Zilberstein traveled to a government archive in Moscow to study the original manuscript of The Master and Margarita by the Russian novelist Mikhail Bulgakov, who died from kidney disease at age 48 in 1940. In the library, he covered the manuscript pages with ground-up polymer beads. Then Rigetti used mass spectrometry to analyze the molecules Zilberstein had captured and found liberal traces of morphine. In a subsequent paper published the Journal of Proteomics, they concluded that Bulgakov was self-medicating with the drug while he wrote. Rigetti describes the response as a barrage of criticism. One critic complained that the method risked contaminating fragile pages with the ground-up beads. Another questioned their conclusion, pointing to the lack of any written record of Bulgakov taking morphine at this time, despite a period of addiction earlier in his life. The drug was present on the pages, the critic said. It could have come from later readers, perhaps Russian Secret Service agents studying the subversive text, an objection that Rigetti and Zilberstein agreed was legitimate. We will continue this article on our next program, as we have run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.